Welcome back to Finding Hope, Cancer Screening is the Future. In this second part of our conversation on pediatric cancer and HPV, Dr. Mort Murray opens up the discussion speaking to the importance of looking at the entire family as your patient. And Dr. Nemechek gives us some insight into outpatient care and the available services.
When you're working with patients, working with children, and there's still that stage in their life, of course, where there are so many different elements of the support system. You have the parents, you have the aunts, the uncles, you have older and younger siblings. So in many ways, I can imagine, you know, you're treating the patient, but this is a whole family situation and the way that you have to engage. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I definitely can. I guess the first word I would use is challenging. There's nothing easy about it. It's challenging. And I think one thing as a provider that you have to really grasp is the patient is the family. Mm. It's not just one person. The patient is the family. And you have to approach it from that mindset. And I think when you recognize and appreciate that as you're taking care of that one individual who has that diagnosis, you are also impacting and taking care of all of the members that support that individual.
Right.
And they all come together. They're not exclusive. You can't give a cancer diagnosis and only impact the patient. The parents are going to have an experience based on that diagnosis. The first dose of chemo is going to impact Harry's and the siblings, not just the person who's getting that toxic drug. And I think with that mindset, it really provides the opportunity to make your best attempt at providing what I consider to be competent and holistic care, you know, looking at the full picture, the whole person, the whole group, not just one individual aspect of it.
In this next segment, Anita talks about the importance of exercise and nutrition when it comes to recovery. Could you speak a little bit about the outpatient care and what services may be available to parents and also other family members that are supporting this child going through treatment? Because I can imagine, you know, it's different. We all are supporting our family members with as much love and understanding and care as possible. But traditionally, like, we don't have the skills as caregivers, you know? So we're also learning and going through the process with that family member. Could you speak to some of the services available for parents?
Yeah, I will speak about services, but first of all, I was going to tell you, I love when families are involved. I think there's nothing scarier for a human, adult or kid, to do this by themselves. Yeah. And what we tend to do as humans when we find something that scares us is to withdraw.
Yep. Yep.
In some cultures, more than others, and I come from a culture where we go the other way around. And then everybody gets involved, which is awesome, but it can be a lot on the families. I think the support of family is so important for cancer care. To try to leave things as normal as possible before all this started reassures people that they can do this. And I think that's really important. From the hospital side, that week that I told you when we're meeting, we function as a village in an oncology unit. We are a big neighborhood. We have the doctors, which of course now are doing the care, the nurses who are our left and our right hand for everything that we do. We have social workers. Every patient meets a social worker. It's not because they have problems. It's because everybody needs
support, yes,
of a social worker. We have a team that we call the Bridges team at Dornbecker, which is essentially a team that works with decision-making with the families. So they introduce to the family, they kind of become almost a third party to talk about things you forgot to talk about your doctor in terms of how you make decisions, who makes decisions in your house. Now, if things don't go the way we plan them, what are your wishes? What's your value system in terms of how far to go with treatment and things like that? We have pharmacists, we have nutritionists. I mean, we are on a first name basis with the people that help us keep our unit clean there. So we all know each other. And I have great stories of that. I will come in sometimes to the unit to work, and one of our environmental assistants comes in and goes, "You got to go and look at room this and this." they're not doing so well today. And that we need that. We need that because people feel safe, and because it's safer for the patient in general.
In this next segment, Anita talks about the importance of exercise and nutrition when it comes to recovery.
You mentioned nutritionists. What part in recovery does nutrition and diet and exercise play?
Very important. Again, maintaining good health, your immune system responds to the way you eat and the way you sleep and the way you exercise. That is part of our gasoline, if you want to think about it that way.
Yeah, that's a good way, good way to put it.
I get a lot of questions about this. And again, in my culture, in Latino, everybody has a recipe to cure you. And you must try them all, right? I think nutrition is important because it keeps that immune system awake and allows for recovery of the cells. There's no special diet. You need a balanced diet. You try not to eat as much processed food, which we all should be doing to begin with. And you do work with the nutritionist to make sure you're getting enough calories. One thing that happens very commonly for patients with cancer is that they stop eating. And when you don't nourish yourself, you get more prone to infections and the treatment not working. So we have people counting calories and teaching parents, you know, what to feed their children and how to eat. We don't really have any special food you need to eat. It's just mostly making sure that you get what you need.
Hesitancy with participating in research is a very common thing. As parents, we will naturally be even that much more protective of our children. I asked Dr. Murray for some help with easing the tension around allowing our children to participate in research.
What's some advice you could give to parents who may fear their children participating in research?
Yeah. No, that's a great point and a great question. I think the best advice I can give kind of goes back to my previous point, which is that, first off, this is research in the 21st century, you know. We have this, you know, this very volatile history that reflects on this whole process of research with regards to the African American and the Black community in a very negative light.
Yep.
Right. The history may have not changed, but the practice, the approach, and the methodologies are night and day, right? We're in a place now where there is protection for research subjects. There are standardized processes, there are protocols, there are requirements, and people and organizations and research institutions are held accountable to those. I'm not saying that means that things that we fear won't happen or there is not a chance that they will happen, but the rate of it happening and the likelihood of happening is so minimal now compared to what it was historically. And you know that this negative history exists, and it's loaded and it's volatile.
Yeah.
But I think we really have to get to the place where, as a group, we recognize and say it's time to move past this. Things are not like that anymore. Although things may be concerning and fearful, it's okay to take that step forward and reengage the system, and reengage it. And I'm not saying just go in blindly. Reengage it. Thoughtfully and intelligently, and recognize, you know, when there are concerns and bring them up, you know. And I think that's a big piece of really being able to, as a parent, being able to find comfort in knowing my child is safe in doing this, and recognizing that, you know, that this isn't just them that's going forward and doing this. There's other people. There's a larger population, and there's something more at stake than just the risk, right?
Yeah.
It's that knowledge acquisition and that data that's needed. Not to go off on a tangent, but I want to give you a really good example of this, right? Sickle cell patients. I work with the sickle cell population, okay? If you're Black, somewhere along the line, you were probably related to somebody with sickle cell disease or sickle cell trait. Mm-hmm. I mean, the chances are so high, right? We have so little research on sickle cell disease. We have so little data to prove that disease is damaging, debilitating, and leads to death in our patient, in this patient population. And the reason for that is that the research hasn't happened. A lot of the research doesn't exist. And the hesitancy and the fear that goes with engaging the system and allowing that research to happen, along with the lack of resources, you know, the lack of support for that population to be invited into that research,
man,
all those things have accumulated into this massive barrier where this large population, I'm talking large population of people,
right?
You know, we're talking hundreds of thousands globally, maybe millions globally, who have this condition and who have only had, what, 4 treatments come about since the early 90s?
Wow.
Because this research doesn't exist and there isn't the data to say, this is concerning, this is severe, something needs to happen, here's the proof, here's the data, let's do something. It wasn't until just recently that, you know, we really started moving forward and doing this research and starting to see the impact of the research and the release of new treatments for this population of patients. This goes across the board to cancer patients and everybody else.
Subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Finding Hope. Cancer Screening is the Future, available everywhere you listen to podcasts. Presented by OHSU Knight Cancer Institute. For more information on the OHSU Knight Cancer Institute, visit www.ohsu.edu/Knight-Cancer-Institute.